Hi. Okay, so this is the last of our three-part interview with Henry Shukman Roshi. And we've covered so far that your journey, the discovery of the process of falling away, and then the discovery of this profound sense of love in which heart plays really a deep and profound role. So the last section really is, well, given this set of wonderful discoveries, how might this be brought into the world, particularly around one area in which I'm particularly interested and involved these days, which is community health. And it just turns out that in the at least in the United States, many other countries, that hospitals and providers, healthcare providers, are either required by law or address a cluster of health challenges which have very strong behavioral components. Those being, for example, health literacy or chronic illnesses, hypertension, cardiac issues, obesity, another good example, issues, mental depression, burnout, this phenomenon where you lose all sense of direction, you lose energy in places like Japan, the sudden death syndrome, all related to profound energetic enervation. And finally, drug and substance abuse with pandemic here in Santa Fe in New Mexico. Every one of these has a behavioral component, a significant behavioral component, which means that the patient and the healthcare providers and the caregivers have a significant ambit, a domain in which they can beneficially early detect, prevent, and cure. And what's so fascinating, the discovery that I made is that, and our team made, that if you can make progress in any one of these domains in which a behavioral component is significant, well, then that multiplies. You can multiply it across other health domains. And it sets up really what the Malcolm, others have talked about a tipping point, and the Santa Fe Institute is so interested. You build a multiplier and you reach a state in which a very small additional beneficial change then has a huge cascade. And this is right available here with Santa Fe. So perhaps I'm interested to explore with you this, because everything you've been talking about relates to behavioral change at a much more deep level, of course. But when we're speaking of the habits that we have, these existential clingings to stories, and that there is a capacity to move them away, move us away to discover what is an alternative available reality. Well, so what? Let's use Alzheimer's as an example. I mean, Alzheimer's, we just know, recently known that the state of New Mexico is experiencing a 36% uptick in Alzheimer's. So how does behavioral change enter into Alzheimer's? Well, it enters into several things. If you are able, as I believe we are, to detect Alzheimer's early and to prevent it. You know, late Alzheimer's, where most of the research money has been devoted, is really a fundamental collapse of the whole architecture. It's probably many different illnesses that are conflating. But if you can detect it early, we may very well, both whether it be pharmaceutically, but certainly in alternative ways, can affect behavior that directly in the ways that you're talking about. And certainly for caregivers who are putting their life, their family, everything at stake, to be able to give them a sense that there is an alternative that they can recharge, rejuvenate, and to bring heart and behavior into the wealth capital that exists in the community so that it is more readily available to those who are really at the front lines, and then to bring the behavioral change to move away from a competitive capitalist model for community, because Alzheimer's is generally perceived as a personal and family catastrophe. And we are just beginning to understand, no, this is far more a community-wide medical, social, economic, spiritual catastrophe. So we can get ahead of it. We can save millions of dollars of wasted money, but even more importantly, we can save lives. And I think your work, as we've been describing, is really germane, particularly in this area of behavioral change, both for patients, because we know that behavioral change early can have epigenetic effects. We can actually affect the influence the expression of genes. And certainly for caregivers, it will give them a sense of hope and comfort and belonging. And also for the foundations and the community as a whole, I think it is of profound importance. But I'm really interested less in me being an advocate for you, and much more important in your own words. What are your thoughts about all of this, which I think is, for me, is such a vivid opportunity of goodness, or for goodness?
Yeah, well, may I just say, Julian, no need to, you know, use the word Roshi with me. Just Henry's enough.
Okay, Henry's enough.
Yeah. I see, in a sense, two things that we're doing here in Mountain Cloud. One is the sort of deep Zen training for those that want it. It's available here. If that somehow is what your heart brings you to, it's here. But on the other hand, we have a much broader practice that we're offering to the community here, wider community here. And our whole, and we call it the Rio Grande Mindfulness Institute, basically to keep Zen out of the way, and this word mindfulness has become very palatable and acceptable
right.
in mainstream world. So what we did was we formed this so that we could sort of, if I may put it like this, sort of infiltrate a little bit of peace and quiet and stillness and mindfulness into schools. It's what we've been doing is offering retreats for public school teachers to come here, and they get 40 teachers come at a time. They get a day for them, a day of remembering. We used that word in an earlier part of this series, that they come and they really discover the wonder of mindfulness, which is actually reconnecting with our own heart, is how I would describe it. Remembering.
The member is the heart. Remembering
yes.
the heart.
Yes, yeah. yes, yes. And from that, we find that in stillness and in simple awareness. No challenge. It's not difficult stuff. It's very nurturing, and it helps people rediscover their own self-compassion, their own self-love. And for a teacher, that's just vital, because so many teachers are dealing with burnout. In this part of the world, they're very unsupported or under-supported. And so what we're finding is that for one teacher, or maybe a little cohort of four or five teachers from one school, to be experiencing this and to be tasting it and finding that, yes, it's worth it, you know, I'll do a little practice myself. And they then bring it into school in the smallest way. They might offer, one week they decide for 60 seconds, they'll have a class, be quiet, and just breathe together. And it changes the atmosphere in the room. And that endures. And the kids say, can we do that again, miss or mister? You know, and it is actually a community health multiplier. It can work yes. into a school system. Yeah. And we're seeing that that's actually happening. And everybody benefits. And when you start having little pockets of peace introduced to the day of a whole community, like a school, it really starts to sow seeds of change in a subtle, gentle, but profound way. And it's actually possible. We're now actually getting, there's a movement is starting in northern New Mexico in public education. You can feel it. And it's a perfect example of what you've been talking about, I think, and how it leads to behavior change is precisely what it does. Through people tasting a little bit of self-compassion, what does it spontaneously lead to is the possibility of more compassion expressed in relationships.
And what I'm discovering is that probably every community, but I'm discovering it in Santa Fe and Santa Barbara, that there is a deep reservoir and treasure of talent, of skill, of resources that communities can draw upon. Many of them are disconnected. Many people don't, probably many people are not even aware of your Rio Grande Institute. But that's really wonderful. And we, part of the protocol that we are using in this, we call it CHIME, Community Health Multipliers, and this was the advice of a wonderful member of our group, Professor Stephen Post, who's at the Stony Brook Medical School. He said, begin in small groups. And Margaret Mead famously said, you know, there are very few things in this world of greatness that haven't begun with small groups. And I had this dream the other night, and it was about this voice said to me, because I was pondering all the small groups, and it said to me, the power of 10. And I initially said, well, 10, what a measly number. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. What can you possibly accomplish with 10 people? But then I sort of said, well, maybe 10 is, it seems an interesting mathematical number. So I went to the, you know, I took a baby course from the Khan Academy at 2 o'clock in the morning on 10. And I began to see what happens with 10 exponentially. I mean, if 10 people, and you say you could, people, you can convey this in an instant, a minute or two, they get self-compassion. And suppose you do it over a period of weeks, and then they start to talk to other people, and they help to train other people, or they send them to your institute. It starts to get, you know, from 10 you go to 100 to 1,000, all of a sudden you're at 10,000. Pretty soon you're at 1,000,000 people.
Yeah, no. Well, we reckon if 40 teachers come to one of our days, 4,000 kids are affected.
Yeah. So you have the Santa Fe Institute interested in complex systems and chaotic systems and multiplier and so-called weak connections. There was a man just gave a talk on the power of weak connections, not strong connections, to affect the fusion of behavioral change. You don't want to clump it too tightly because it can affect the fusion if it's weak connections. Just the word gets out and people begin to explore and play on their own. You have an opportunity here, as you're saying, to build this foundation for this community that can have a profound multiplier effect across all these spectrum of illnesses that are that are costing the state hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, that a solution is amenable if we just move away from a sort of small heart competitive model, mm-hmm. that one is embracive, inclusive, compassionate, heart-centric, and collaborative.
Yeah, and I love that weak connection. So in other words, it really resonates, the sort of sense that actually, if we're just sort of, in some ways, true to what we find to be true, if we're have integrity in that and are true in that, we don't need to influence others, grab others, coerce others at all. We just stay true to that,
right,
and let it ripple out as it does.
It will.
Yes, I think that's absolutely
and this
right.
This is right at the frontier.
But isn't that why spirituality has gone wrong over the centuries?
Exactly. And this is at the frontier of what the Santa Fe Institute top is called the science of contagion. This is lecture at the LENSIC that I went to a few weeks ago. But it's at the heart of what we're talking about. And here, you know, the state is economically fragile.
It's positive diffusion.
Well, yeah, positive diffusion. It's economically fragile. You just take this one slice, Alzheimer's, you know, 36% increase. It could bankrupt the state over the next few years. I don't know whether there's any plan to deal with it at a community-wide level. Mm. And yet here the resources are right available, the talent, the skill, the wisdom.
Yeah.
And so this is, I hope, a project that, and if I can interest Santa Barbara and Baltimore, you know, there's a particularly poignant dimension of all this, because this falls, this, Alzheimer's, diabetes, all these illnesses we're talking about, including forms of cancer, on the poorest, the most vulnerable, the minorities, the Native Americans, the poor Hispanics, and so forth. In Baltimore, East Harlem, Washington, on the African American community, they become sicker, more seriously, and they die younger simply because they don't have assets. You know, this is a profound health justice issue that this country has not really looked at squarely. Coming back again to the role of, I call it big heart intelligence, you call it the heart-centric mindfulness. But this practice, what you were talking about, is critical to awaken us to this desperate situation in which people are dying today, a large part of which is preventable if we could simply pay attention and engage not just our minds, but our hearts.
Well, I think what you were saying at the start of this segment about the model of providers and recipients, providers and customers, it's actually the opposite of a community.
Yes.
Isn't it? Really, it's and to rebuild and reform or generate community
consciousness about it.
Yes.
But this is not in any way an antagonistic model to the providers. This is a collaborative one. Right. This is in the enlightened interest of companies, of research organizations, so that they could, welcome a collaboration. Their research will become better if the community's in guide. It will be more directed to the people on the ground who are really suffering, If we can connect at the level of heart, there will be this kind of a paradigm, this framework shift that you've been talking about, but a real embodiment of what desperate challenges.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm really happy to hear about this because, the kind of thing that we do here on one side is just not for everybody. We don't want to have a model whereby you can't really get helped unless you're going to spend years of your life on a cushion.
Right.
That's not very practical at all. So we've got, that's why we have this other institute that, but I mean, I think what you're talking about is really wonderful. And I know of some new forms of psychology actually that are becoming popular that are much more community-based. They're no longer the old model of the psychologist who knows, who's the expert, and the patient who's the victim and who needs help.
Right.
Instead, it's actually about empowering small community groups. And they can be profoundly healing for people who are part of that. It's a very, anyway, I think that's probably related in some ways to what
very much so, about. Very much so.
And so I'm very interested in that. And I think, I mean, in our little experiment here as a Sangha, just to see what happens when people sit together, when the reason they're together, what's drawn them to be together, is the silent sitting together. But what comes out of that is a whole network of relationships that form in new ways and that we wouldn't really couldn't possibly have anticipated. There's no anticipating what forms of flourishing come out of a group of people being silent together. Yeah.
And actually my work in this Chime project has really made me appreciate more the wisdom of the Sangha, because the Sangha really is a small community connected at the level of heart, which is involved in a discovery process. That is what a Sangha is.
Perfectly.
And the ancients understood it perfectly. Anyway, maybe we end at this note, but I really thank you for your time today, and I hope that this seeds a voyage together, of adventure together, but also for all those that listen to this, that they become interested and reach out to each other and to us, and that we create a more expanded Sangha for health, wellness, and joy in the world.
Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely. Can I say one more little
thing?
Yes,
please, please.
This popped into my head. As you know, Julian, this Zen line that we've both been touched by is called Three Treasures Zen. And the three treasures are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha.
Yes.
Buddha, I take to be that falling away of everything, opening to nothing. Dharma, everything pouring into being. Out of that. And Sangha, the community.
Which is embodied,
Exactly, the community of all things. Utter, intimate fellowship of all things and all beings. So that's more or less what we've been talking about.
It is. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Henry.